My guest today is Joseph Nucci, although you may know him from his social media handle at Joe Nucci, where he shares his ideas about therapy speak and the colloquial use of trauma.
You know, when trauma was first formulated as a diagnosis, it was very controversial. Events themselves aren't traumatic. Our responses to them are. You know, once something gets over 1,000 views and listens, it's just not about you anymore. The medicalization of everyday life is something that I think about, and it's something I'm a little bit concerned about as these terms become more popular. By overgeneralizing that everything is just trauma, which, and maybe what some people mean by that is life is really hard and life can be really stressful, and which, betcha, it can. That brings me to narcissism. Listen, I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, empathic people out there, and, you know, whether or not they, you know, should claim the identity of empath is a different conversation, but I've seen it more than once in my practice where people come in and they say, you know, I have, you know, I'm an empath and I do a history, and it's like, well, it also sounds like you have some trauma.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
My guest today is Joseph Nucci, although you may know him from his social media handle at Joe Nucci, where he shares his ideas about therapy speak and the colloquial use of trauma. My friend George shared one of Joe's posts recently on his stories on Instagram, and it hit me between the eyes because I just thought, this is the account that I've been looking for. In an age where we've never been more literate about mental health, it feels as though these words are being used to label and not really much more. And as someone who has clawed their way back from the depths of depression, I don't feel this is helpful. And I would like to see this change, which is why seeing Joe's account made me so happy and why I shared it immediately. And it was only when quite a few followers said, surely he's a podcast guest, thanks in particular to Yasmin, that I reached out, and I'm delighted to say he said yes. Joe is a practicing psychotherapist who opened Denver Minds in Colorado and now lives and works in New York. He was born in California and raised in Monterey and earned a master's in clinical counseling from Northwestern University. The post of Joe's that I saw began, "This is going to piss off a lot of people, but I have to say it. I am so over the cult of trauma." And that feels like an excellent place to start. Welcome to the Emma Gunn Show, Joe. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a real pleasure. So talk to me about these posts that you put up, because I think they are brilliant. They are so well thought out, but I've alluded to it. Many of them start with, "You're not going to like this, but..."
Yeah, well, my kind of social media content creation journey, I became more serious about it almost by accident. I made my first short form video post on April 17th, I think it was. And at the time I was only being followed by friends and family. It was my 10th or 15th post. I made a post about, you know, about cognitive therapy. Basically, I said, you don't have to believe everything you think. And I talked about that truism in psychotherapy, and it's fallen off the algorithm now, but I think it rounded off like just under 1 million views. It got 130,000 in the first 24 hours. And it was, the first time I'd experienced anything like that. And for a really long time, I was trying to figure out, you know, I love being a therapist. I love private practice. And it was like, what else? I almost went to law school. I thought about getting my PhD. I thought about getting involved in kind of like the tech venture capital side of mental health. And I started the videos really to, advertise for the practice. That's how a lot of, you know, service businesses advertise for themselves now. And so, but when things started getting viewed a lot, I started taking it a little bit more seriously. And when I started taking it a little bit more seriously, I started to read, you know, about the science of virality, and started to just kind of think like, okay, well, what do we know what works? And you may remember, if you followed any of like the US politics stuff, that in the 2016 election, for example, a little moral outrage goes viral quicker. And you know, that's not good or bad. It just is, in my opinion. And so I thought to myself, is there anything about this field that genuinely, you know, irks me? And can I talk about it on camera? And it's not to be contrarian, like just for likes, for the sake of, you know, getting high impressions, right? It's actually, well, there's anything that actually matters to me. And the topic that you brought up, the misuse and sometimes abuse of certain psychological terms, therapy speak, also irks me a little bit. And so when I made that video, I mean, I knew it would get engagement. I didn't think it would be like, I think it's like at 5.5 million views on Instagram alone. And when I posted it, I think I only had like, excuse me, I think I only had like, what, like 30,000 followers at the time. So that's, it's kind of an outlier in terms of certain viral posts. And I guess I share all of that to say that, you know, the framing is a bit intentional and there's an authentic piece to it as well. And I think the reason I wanted to speak on it was because when I started making content like I did, I started consuming mental health content more. And it's just, it may sound funny, but as a therapist, I wasn't really doing that before. Like, I was just getting my information from other places. And I don't fault content creators for, you know, oversimplifying things or not adding a ton of nuance, because I get it. It's really hard in 90 seconds to, you know, make something very nuanced. But some of the things I were seeing were just wrong. And it was from licensed professionals. And it really started to hit me when I was socializing with friends. You know, New York City, a lot of my friends are very professional. They're very highly educated. They were starting to use the terms like some of the popular accounts that I see. And, you know, when I'm talking to my friends, you know, I'm not in therapist mode. I'm not in content creator mode. I'm not, you know, looking to kind of correct people there and then. It's kind of like, you know, I'm sure lawyers notice when people are not like maybe misuse grammar or something, you know, there's a time and place, but I think that social media in some ways is the public square. And so I made that post because I think the word trauma is misunderstood and misused. And in a way it's a good problem to have, right? Because I think that it's a good thing that more people, you know, are talking about trauma and have some idea what it is and are a little bit more aware of it. But that doesn't mean that we, just because that's a good thing, doesn't mean we can't talk about the downsides and the problems that I think are emerging.
And what are those problems, do you think, that are emerging with what I would say is perhaps more of us than ever before identifying as having been traumatized and not necessarily then knowing what to do with that trauma?
Yeah. Well, I think that I made a post about this, but, you know, when trauma was first formulated as a diagnosis, it was very controversial. But a lot of the studies have come in and, you know, people more or less agree that this is a thing. It creates changes in your nervous system and the brain. There's certain studies coming out now looking at like epigenetics and how it can actually change things on a very, very deep level. And it moved on from this very kind of rigid definition of PTSD to this more kind of dimensional definition of trauma, where it's like you could have some PTSD symptoms, but not all of them, but the trauma is still very legitimate. And then there was this kind of introduction of this big T trauma versus little T trauma. So big T traumas are like you were in a car accident or a plane crash or in a war. And then little T trauma is a trauma reaction to something that is not maybe kind of classically thought of as something very traumatic, but the introduction of this concept of little T trauma really highlights how events themselves are not traumatic. It's, we have trauma responses to them. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I see a lot of people, so that's the first thing. People actually talk about events like they're traumatic unto themselves. Some people, you know, go to war and develop PTSD. There's this really wonderful book, I think, called is it called Belong by Sebastian? I don't know how to pronounce his last name. It's Junger. Where I remember reading about how if you actually look at veterans and people who participate in the military in Israel, they actually have really low rates of PTSD. And the reason they have lower rates is because, well, number one, Israel is like always at war, right? So there actually isn't like, so that's they're constantly like have that, those the stimuli, you know, yeah. That might be triggering for someone who's at war and then comes home to a country that's not at war. Then there's, you know, also the fact that, you know, two people can get into a car accident like you and I, and you might develop PTSD and I might walk away a little shaken up, which is fine. And so that's the number one thing. I think that it's events themselves aren't traumatic. Our responses to them are. And that doesn't mean that the trauma isn't important and doesn't do everything people says it does. But I think that's a more helpful way to think about it, because the subjective nature of it's really confusing, right? When it's subjective, that's the second thing I think people get wrong. Because of that subjective nature, people then start to say, well, if I say it's a trauma response, that's what it is. But nowhere in my knowledge has any, you know, significant writing or literature or studies on trauma have said, well, anything can be defined as trauma, because now we've exited, you know, kind of clinical mental health terminology. And then it becomes like a linguistic problem. It becomes a problem of definitions.
I think this touches on something really interesting as well, where lived experience is now equal to evidence-based data and science. So you could present as much as you want to me scientifically proven studies about X, Y, or Z, and I could say, but my lived experience is this, and we're at an impasse. Whereas before, science and evidence would have outweighed the lived experience somewhat.
Yeah. Well, I think it's something that I sometimes talk about, and I want to talk about it more, is really encouraging people to become kind of research literate. And so my undergraduate education was at Wesleyan University, and it's a research institution. Like, that's what you do in a lot of the classes there. You actually publish papers and talk about them. And the psychological papers that you might find have limitations, and any sort of social science, any social scientist, I should say, worth their salt is going to do kind of a multivariate analysis of a problem. They're actually going to look at, you know, multiple factors that are contributing to the problem. And they're all always going to recognize that there are almost always outliers. And so there may be trends, and the very strong trends in psychological sciences are trends for a reason, but that doesn't mean they apply to every single person. And so if I, you know, talk about trauma or anxiety, and I refer to a paper that's, you know, very rigorously studied, and someone comments, well, this doesn't apply to me. Okay, like, great, you know, or not so great, I guess, depending on the finding of the paper. But I think that's actually very normal. And there are very few, one of the reasons why therapists are so typically saying, well, you know, it's not good or bad, it just is, you know, they're very kind of, they like to think in the gray. They like to think in the gray area, is because that's, human experience is complicated and it's messy. I think people who really want to find really kind of like hard, rigid truths about the human experience, I'm not totally sure psychology is going to offer a lot of that. It's a little bit more new, and that's why I love it personally.
So when you started putting out content, I'm curious if just by dint of having put out what you have put out, whether you ended up getting responses from people. You got people like me going, yes, thank goodness, I really align with this. I am totally into what you're saying. But then I wonder if you get the responses of, you're minimizing my lived experience, you're minimizing my trauma, and whether that's something you've experienced.
Yeah. So in the post that you brought up initially, most of the comments have been positive. There have been a lot of negative ones. I'm still very new to this industry and very new to content creation. And one of the best pieces of advice I got was from a friend who works in media. And he said that, you know, once something gets over 1,000 views and listens, it's just not about you anymore. Like, it's your face. It may even be your idea or belief, but you created a product that might as well be an entity that is going to go live a life cycle people out on the internet, and you just need to go let it live and let people interact with it the way you do. It's been a very comforting piece of advice. I also think it's true, because some of the responses, you know, even some of the responses, like some people have taken it to be like, yes, like, you know, trauma is, can I swear on here?
Go ahead.
Okay. It's like some people have taken it to be like, yes, like trauma is bullshit. And if that's your takeaway from this video, you didn't listen to the video, in my opinion. And if the, on the other side of things is like, well, you're invalidating my experience. This was the trauma that I went through. I also don't think you listened to the video, like respectfully, you know, and compassionately, because I'm so sorry that happened to you. It sounds like you have pretty classic PTSD. I don't think that this problem that I'm discussing applies to you.
Yes, because it is. It's the pathologizing of normal, reasonable, and rational human emotions, I think, which is what we're seeing. So, for example, if you are going to a job interview, it is perfectly rational and reasonable to have a human feeling of nervousness, but that's not anxiety. And if you have a day where you wake up and you feel a bit blue, maybe you have a couple of those in a row and life is a bit tough, work's difficult, those few days don't mean depression. Potentially you might have to keep an eye on it, but it's that, isn't it? It's that sort of, we're very, very quick to label our feelings. And I'm interested to know what you think about that. But I also think it feeds into a much bigger piece, which is this idea that life should be happy at all times. And so if there's anything, even a sort of a speck of dust on your happiness landscape, then you think it has been ruined. And therefore you use a very medical term to describe that feeling, even if actually what it is you're just feeling a bit uneasy today.
Yeah. The, you know, the medicalization of everyday life is something that I think about. And it's something I'm a little bit concerned about as these terms become more popular. The examples of using anxious and depressed in a more kind of colloquial way, I'm less concerned about that, just because, you know, people are allowed to exaggerate. They're allowed to be a little dramatic. That's just kind of how they express themselves. And I think that's okay. I think that if you really want to prioritize being really mental health literate and destigmatizing mental health, then maybe you should actually use other words. Like, I'm feeling blue. I'm feeling down. I'm not feeling very motivated today. I'm, you know, really in my head today. I'm anticipating a lot. I'm nervous. I think that's fine. The reason why trauma has captured my attention is because the way I was trained is that even if someone tells you about an event, like in therapy, one-on-one, if someone tells you about an event that's objectively sounds like it could be pretty traumatizing, like maybe they disclose physical abuse that happened to them when they were younger or something like that, you don't necessarily dive in with labels right away, because if they're not actually experiencing signs of trauma, you don't actually want to inadvertently traumatize them or kind of embed these certain trauma reactions and introduce narratives of having trauma reactions when there aren't any. And this is something that the field has actually dealt with before. So if you kind of track the history of mental health, you may remember hearing about something called like the satanic panic. I think this was in like the 70s and 80s, where clinicians, I believe it was mostly hypnotists, but also I think people practicing psychoanalysis, if I'm not mistaken, we're kind of, you know, saying like, oh, well, you've completely repressed this memory of, you know, sexual abuse or childhood abuse. And there was like a famous court case where it was like proven, it's like, this didn't happen, you know, but the person ended up believing that it did happen. And so if that can happen one-on-one in therapy, I don't know why other people aren't more concerned that by using the word trauma interchangeably with stress, that's what I think often happens. People say that was traumatizing. What they mean is that was stressful or that impacted me. I don't know. I think it's a pretty reasonable concern personally. I haven't cracked it open yet. It's actually somewhere on my shelf here, but there's this book that was recommended to me by a follower, and it's called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. And it's about how people like to kind of, you know, absolve themselves from, you know, any sort of responsibility when mistakes are made. And it's they go through a lot of different examples, but apparently in there where they talk about therapists in inpatient units in like the psych ward who were treating people. They were kind of coming in with what we would call like a borderline level of functioning. So in psychodynamic psychotherapy or in psychoanalysis, they there's kind of a spectrum of functioning, and borderline is not like borderline personality disorder. It means like basically like you're it's a commentary on your level of functioning, like within your mind. And they were actually leaving worse. And it was because people were kind of not being responsible with how they were kind of discussing these issues of the mind. And so I don't want to sound overly alarmist. I don't think that there's this like, you know, mass epidemic of people, you know, kind of falsifying their trauma. Because on the other side of it, it's been really stigmatized until recently. And I wholeheartedly, you know, agree with that. But I think that there's a nuance there that's really, really important. And it just, it kind of blows my mind that I've seen some content creators who presumably know this about trauma. Maybe they don't, but presumably they know. And then they get on camera and then they say something like, your whole personality is just a trauma response. Mm. No, it's not. The whole field of personality psychology would actually disagree with you. You know? And I know you have to kind of wonder what's going on there. Is it incompetency? Is it a semantic linguistic issue? Are they just trying to advertise their practice? I don't know.
It's very interesting. And the fact that will come up between like somebody eating noodles and somebody on TikTok, yes. You've got all these the fact that it will be sandwiched between the most random videos. And then it's like, hey, do you sometimes feel anxious? Well, everyone's going to stop and listen to that. That could be because your entire personality is a trauma response. Like, who isn't going to? The thing is that sows a very dangerous seed. It's like a Japanese knotweed, because even if you don't quite know what it means, even if you don't know what your trauma is, once that seed is planted, you might come back to it the next time you have a difficult day or the next time something trips you up. But that is just life, isn't it? It's not necessarily because you're looking for the trauma that caused the issue.
Yeah, sure. I think that's absolutely right. And I think the other thing that I haven't mentioned is that by overgeneralizing that everything is just trauma, and maybe what some people mean by that is life is really hard and life can be really stressful, and which betcha it can. I think that they're actually robbing people of these other distinctions that might actually help them understand themselves better and improve their mental health. And so I'll just give you actually a personal example. I lost my dad when I was younger, quite unexpectedly. And looking back, even though I was 11 at the time, but looking back, it's like, yeah, some of that looks like what we might consider like a textbook trauma response. Understandably, me at my age now, I don't have trauma for my dad's loss. From losing my dad, it still impacts me, you know. And you know, we can have a whole separate conversation about grief, but you know, in my personal therapy, on my personal journey, one of the more helpful reflections I ever got from a therapist was, you know, don't look at this as something that, you know, that is like good or bad or like traumatic in a sense, but it's a part of your story. You know, this thing happened to you and it's impacting you. And how is it impacting you now? How is it showing up in your romantic relationships now, in your work life now, in whatever it is? And to say that it's, you know, that, oh, well, all the ways that losing my dad impacted me is because of trauma, I think it completely actually invalidates a lot of the more, you know, I think colorful and even sometimes harder human experiences that we have. Does that make sense? That it's kind of like, well, there's actually like so much more to learn about myself outside of this one concept, this one framework, this one buzzword.
Well, if you were in isolation to say a child at the age of 11 lost a parent, most people's response to that very black and white information would be, gosh, that must have been terrible. I don't think actually many people would say trauma, but the initial sort of flash response to that is that must have been terrible. But as you say, that doesn't accommodate any nuance into that experience of the actual individuals involved, the circumstances and all of those things. And so maybe these labels are almost labels of of labels, of just kind of these little stick figure situations as opposed to the real situation, because then it becomes quite cookie cutter, doesn't it?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the one of, I had a supervisor in grad school, and she was very fond of saying, like, you know, remember N equals one, like you're treating this patient. And it's like, yes, we have all these studies and trends and science and like the art of psychotherapy and the theory of all the stuff that we can pull from. But it's like, at the end of the day, like N equals one, it's like, this is an individual sitting in front of you. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm still very early in my career, but if I've learned one thing, it's, man, people are so different from each other. It really is a treat and a privilege to kind of get to know that side of people's, you know, minds and their lived experience, because I'm surprised all the time. Like I'm anticipating that, you know, they'll, you know, say that, you know, that was traumatic. And then they they'll be like, oh, it wasn't that bad. And then, you know, they continue to talk about, you know, the story, and it's just like, okay, you know.
It's funny. I think I learned the word sonder recently. Is it sonder? I'm now guessing myself, which I hadn't heard before or hadn't seen it used in context, but what you've just said makes me think about that. I think it's sonder. Please let it be sonder. I don't think it is. What is the meaning of sonder? It is not sonder. It must be something else. I'll come back to it another time, but it's basically that every single person is experiencing a reality that they believe to be entirely real and you're a part of it, but they are completely separate and have nothing to do with each other. Maybe it's yonder. Anyway, it's you can tell it's a recent new word that I still haven't committed, but it is, you're right. Everyone can, it's colorful. And I love the fact that you say that seeing this in people is a treat. I like that.
It is a treat. You know, it, even the most, you know, kind of from the patient or client perspective, even the people who are most practiced at receiving psychotherapy, if you see a new therapist, it takes time. It takes time to really open up and kind of, you know, explore certain things. And so I think that the deeper you get with people and the more candid they are with you, it's it is a treat. And I do find it's I used the word privilege earlier. It's like, it's an honor in some ways, because it's an expression of trust, you know, that them opening up to you.
There were a few more things that you've talked about online that I really want to dig into, but I just want to ask you about trauma, just this one little element of it, which I'm somewhat nervous to even bring up, because I'm bringing up from my own personal experience, but also from experiences of a lot of female friends of mine. So I've worked in the media for nearly 25 years. And in that time, I don't know how best to phrase this, but especially in my early career, when I was in my 20s, you would come across, you understood that there were certain men in the industry that you gave them a wide berth. And I will leave it at that. But you just kind of understand that a food chain, you understood where you were on it, and you kind of saw where the apex predators were, and you made sure that you stayed in your pretty safe habitat. And when the Me Too movement happened, I had a lot of quite quiet, definitely not public conversations with quite a lot of girlfriends, some of whom have been in the industry as long as I have, some who've been in longer, who again had come up against people in the entertainment industry and said they were very, very confused, because absorbing all of the information about Me Too, they felt that they should feel traumatized, because actually when they're listening to other people's experiences and they were talking very publicly about their own trauma in that particular area, they realized that they had had similar experiences, but had just gone, that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. And then sort of were having this retroactive retrofitting of should I attach trauma to that or not. And so I think that's quite an interesting thing to sort of look back and realize, actually that was something, but I didn't feel it at the time, so should I relabel it now and package it somewhere else in my brain?
Well, to that I would say, you know, I think one of the reasons why my posts about trauma have been so popular is because I'm asking a question that has kind of one foot in kind of clinical world and then the other foot in culture. And you're asking a cultural question, like, should I word? And I think that for me as a clinician, the way I would use the word is I would use it with a little bit more clinical precision. And so it's not to say that anyone who has talked about any woman or any person who is, you know, speaking about, you know, kind of abuses in power and any sort of kind of, you know, dynamics within sexism or whatever it might be. I'm not saying if when I say like maybe you shouldn't use the word trauma, I'm not saying don't talk about it. I'm just saying that is it, you know, did it really, you know, impact your career trajectory? You know, how did it make you feel? What were, you know, the long lasting implications? And if those were, you know, trauma, then I think use the word. In a lot of ways, it's interesting to even feel uncomfortable having this conversation, because what I'm really saying, and what I think I've said in a lot of my videos, is I think that certain words and certain terms should have like what is it? It's like some sort of like semantic integrity. Like I think there should be a boundary in which the definition stops expanding, and I don't think that that should be controversial. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that it would actually, and the vision is actually, well, hopefully this allows people to feel more connected and more known and seen even more. And I think one of the really interesting praises I've gotten for my posts are from survivors, people who've experienced trauma, PTSD, complex PTSD. And they're all saying like, thank you. What's happened to me? Because everyone thinks they went through something that I went through, or everyone, you know, thinks that they understand my experience when like they actually didn't like need to go to therapy for what happened to them. I'm actually still working on my trauma reactions. I get triggered very, very easily. And this is very, very hard. And I think that if we're going to destigmatize mental health, I think that those people should be allowed to talk about what's happening with them. I personally, you know, my vision for the future of mental health is that people can talk about their trauma. People can talk about their trauma and people understand what it means. Just like when people talk about diabetes, people understand what it means. But in order for that to happen, I think there needs to be an agreed upon parameters on definitions for the word. And wherever we draw that line is where we draw that line. But that's why I'm speaking up about it.
Mm. So do you think at some point we need to, or we have to, not surrender, but Gen Pop maybe does have to surrender some of the vocabulary and let and leave it to you guys? Because otherwise, I could go onto social media and see somebody talking exactly the same way you are and think, yes, I'm in safe hands, yeah. But they're not qualified, that it's snake oil, but they yeah. sound like a psychotherapist.
Right. Yeah, I think that my definition of success around this is not even necessarily that as a culture we figure out, you know, where this line is together. My definition of success is that most people know that there is a debate and conversation about this issue. Number one, I think that the latter is way more achievable. and number two, I think that other subcultures have debates around language as well, and that's normal and healthy in a culture, a subculture, to kind of have that conflict. And number three, this is actually an argument that the clinical community is having. And so while there are people who may pose as psychotherapists selling snake oil, there's also some psychotherapists, most clinicians that I've heard from have agreed with my message. I don't know how much of that is just kind of the echo chambers we see online, but that's been my experience. There are some who haven't agreed with what I have to say, and they conceptualize trauma completely differently than I do. And so that's the other thing I'm very passionate about in terms of when I say like, hey, like, you know, this might, you know, make you a little uncomfortable. Let's talk about this definition, or let's talk about this concept. It's because I had debates about this in class. You know, and then you see a 60-second clip on it online and you think that's the definition. And it's like, no, there's often, you know, a lot of healthy debate. I mean, Freud was alive 100 years ago. You know, psychotherapy is actually pretty new. And so it's not a bad thing that we're having these conversations. So I all that to say is I think that the better solution is to have conversations like this, you know, make podcast episodes and content like this. And so people can actually, who want to learn more and kind of want to get into the nuances of it, can learn.
Mm. Okay. I want to get into a couple of the other areas that you talk about. And one of them is narcissism. Because this is a subject, narcissism really caught my interest a few years ago. And I think I fell into the trap. Or you can tell me, Joe, if I fell into the trap, because I came out of a relationship and felt very, very wounded and very, very damaged and actually very drained. Yeah. And somebody sent me a link to a feature on the Elephant Journal, which was about the empath narcissist dynamic. And there was something so comforting and pleasing about thinking, oh, I am the empath. They were the narcissist. Because I could very simply make it quite binary in that one moment that I read that piece. It says, I was the good, they were the bad. Now, we've come a long way since then, Joe. I totally appreciate there were six of one and half a dozen of the other, and I take accountability for my part in a toxic dynamic. But again, it's like I was saying to you before we started recording, I see something about narcissism online every single day, and I see other people, I see followers, I see people in comments responding, clearly finding that comfort. And I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah, totally. Let's also talk about the term empath while we're at it. I would say a couple of things. I would say, well, first of all, I'm sorry to hear about your relationship. And I want to, if I haven't made a post about this, I should, but I want to normalize, you know, following a breakup particularly, the immediate aftermath of a breakup is not, it is not adaptive or even healthy, I would argue, to be viewing the situation with really great kind of objectivity. Immediately after a breakup, take, you know, the words narcissism and empath out of it. It is normal for it's like, you know, to be talking to your friends and your ex is the devil and you can't believe you were ever in love with them and, you know, you did right. And it's, you know, psychologically, we might call this, you know, dichotomous thinking or splitting, you know. And but that actually, that's a period that I think needs to happen, because if that doesn't happen, why would you move on? You know, if you immediately, you know, the relationships that are often very hard to move on from are the relationships in which it's like, oh, like they're still so great and I really care about them. It's just not a good partnership fit right now, you know, and then you kind of get, it's actually difficult to actually make that separation. And so I think that there's actually something very normal and healthy about that process, even though with psychology speak, you could say that you were binary thinking, you were splitting from a psychodynamic perspective. And yeah, you were. And like, there's actually nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. And so that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, you know, touching what I said earlier, you know, I started taking my content creation more seriously, and I started you know, I noticed it's like, oh, a little moral outrage is actually going to, you know, generate a lot of engagement. Talking about trauma and narcissism and ADHD and neurodivergency gets more engagement. It just does. And so as, you know, therapists want to, you know, make a living, advertise their practice, if they talk about these things, for some reason, I don't know exactly why, but social media, people that use social media want to see posts like that. That brings me to narcissism. I think it's, again, a good problem to have. I think it's a good thing that people are more aware that this is a type of person that they will certainly encounter in their lives. I mean, the prevalence of narcissism and psychopathy, like clinically speaking, is not zero. You know, like, you will meet someone that fits this very textbook clinical definition of this personality disorder at some point in your life, most likely. You know, particularly if you live in like in a city and are interacting with lots of people. And so I do think it's a good thing, but, you know, narcissism is not the same thing as being selfish. It's not the same thing as being, you know, manipulative or abusive. In fact, there are some people who are struggling with narcissism that, don't necessarily, you know, like, take pleasure in abusing people. They may get into relationships, and because of their, because the way their mind is designed, it can be very difficult for their loved ones. But, like, is that the same thing as being, you know, like, a malicious abuser? Like, I don't think so. Or someone might have a trait of narcissism, but that doesn't make them narcissistic. So, for an example, you know, a lot of people, you know, well, in media, let's just use media as an example. It's kind of an act of bravery in some ways, right? You're going to put your face and name out there and tell people what you think and kind of let people decide whatever it is that you may. It takes, you know, at least a little bit of an ego, you know, to be able to put yourself out there like that, right? Does that equate grandiosity? You know, if someone wants, you know, cares about the environment and wants to, you know, save the world, like, are they grandiose, you know, for having those, you know, high-minded ideals? I don't necessarily think so. You know, narcissism, it's a, at least from the DSM, it's a constellation of these different symptoms that, you know, when put together, you know, formulate someone who is pretty narcissistic. And I think that, you know, if you look at social media, it's like, anyone who's mean to you, anyone who acts out of their own self-interest, anyone who doesn't care about your feelings, you know, anyone who is highly disagreeable, you know, anyone who's really competitive and, you know, gets a lot of energy from that. And, you know, people like that, you know, they know exactly what they want and they know exactly how to get it. And, like, think of like a really good lawyer, right? A really good debater. They will push and push and push until they get what they want. And you actually want that in a lawyer, right? Now, you know, I have some very dear friends who are lawyers, and we joke all the time, the things that makes them a great lawyer doesn't necessarily make them a great friend or partner, you know? So they have to, just like the things that make, you know, me a good therapist wouldn't necessarily make me a really, you know, great partner or fun friend to be around either. So, you know, we have these different dimensions to ourselves, but I would say that that's what I want people to take away about narcissism. And I want to do a little riff on empath. Do you have any questions about anything that I just said, or just any like general thoughts?
I'm excited to hear you riff on empath, but I also just think the reason why I want to talk about narcissism a little bit is because I see it thrown around so much, like, oh my God, they were such a narcissist. And again, it's an umbrella term for that person didn't treat me very nicely, or I told that person what my needs were that I needed to have met and they didn't meet them. Therefore they're a narcissist, or they only think about themselves. They didn't think about me. And I think, well, it's as you say, there's a constellation of personality traits, and they could just be a thoughtless prick sometimes, as opposed to like a diagnosed narcissist, which is a very different thing. Again, it's the pathologizing, it's the use of a medical term, of a diagnosis, if you like, to explain away someone's bad behavior or why you don't like somebody, and it warps the meaning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of this, you know, there's a logical fallacy. It's like an appeal to authority. And it's kind of like a sophisticated way of like calling someone like, I don't know, like a jackass, or like, you know, if you want to use like 5-year-old speak, it's like, you're a poopy head. It's like, you're a narcissist. And it's just like, oh, I'm going to use this, you know, more kind of highfalutin label to just basically say, I don't like you very much. And it's like, well, what if you just don't like them very much? You know? What if they're, you know, or what if they're, you know, when it comes to intimate relationships, you know, emotional immaturity, you know, can look like narcissism, because people who are immature are really self-centered. You know, I actually just, it's not out yet. I recorded it in my last film shoot, but I did this video on, like, you know, when you're really stressed or tired or your inner child is activated or whatever it is, it's normal to be really self-centered. You know, and I kind of made this joke in it where I was like, maybe this is why everyone thinks everyone is a narcissist, because mental health stigma is going down, emotional literacy is going up, everyone all of a sudden has permission to work their shit out in the open, you know? And it's like, yeah, when they do that, they're going to be self-centered and not thinking about you. They're not going to be very empathic, you know, in those moments of distress. That's actually normal, you know? And I also recognize that some people, you know, slip into kind of people-pleasing patterns when they're very stressed as well. And so, but both are normal, like both are, you know, known, you know,
Okay,
and
let's riff
so.
on empath. I'm really curious to hear.
All right. So this is actually a more it was one of my more popular videos. So you can go back and check it out if you didn't see it. But basically, I say it's like, hey, like your trauma did not make you an empath. It made you hypervigilant. And so let's actually talk about, you know, hypervigilance and, you know, because it is a trauma term, and it's and again, even though, you know, I'm critical about the misuse of trauma, I want, you know, trauma awareness to spread. And so a very symptom of trauma is to be hypervigilant. You're going to scan your surroundings, you know, for signs of danger, you know, at a rate that is higher than normal. Like it's actually not adaptive, it's not healthy, it's often not sustainable in terms of your nervous system. Hypervigilance can be kind of outward facing, but it can also be inward facing. I've kind of noticed with some patients in therapy that it's like they almost become like overly internally aware. And if it is a trauma reaction, it's because maybe you had a caregiver or, you know, someone in your life, you weren't really allowed to have your own feelings. It was always about them. And so you had to get really good at getting attuned to little subtle changes in their emotional state. You're kind of scanning. It's like, well, you don't want to piss them off. You don't want to make them anxious. You don't want to confuse them. And then on the internal side of things, you're kind of then like scanning yourself for emotions, because you don't want to have to, like, you know, you don't want to present a bad emotion to them. And listen, I'm not saying that there aren't, you know, empathic people out there. And, you know, whether or not they, you know, should claim the identity of empath is a different conversation. But I've seen it more than once in my practice where people come in and they say, you know, I have, you know, I'm an empath and I do a history. And it's like, well, it also sounds like you have some trauma. And we do trauma therapy and they don't identify as an empath anymore, you know, because they realize that they were just constantly scanning for other people's negative emotions. And that's not a fun way to live. And listen, the people in my life who are like genuinely very, very empathic, they don't wear it like it's this, you know, weird badge of honor, like they're a superhero that can like read your mind and they know what you're thinking better than you do. That's actually, I would argue, a little bit delusional. You know, you think you're mind reading and you
That's
can't do that. I can't do that. Like no one, as far as I'm concerned, can do that, you
Edward
know.
Cullen, and that's because he can read your thoughts. Like that's when it gets like supernatural. It's like
You know, and so yeah, so I think again, it's this other pop psychology term. And again, I want to say it twice. Some people, you know, are, you know, probably born with certain empathic capacities that are maybe, you know, higher than normal or higher than average. Sure. Like I haven't done a deep dive into that. I'm pretty sure that's probably true, it seems. But if you look at social media, you know, the rate at which people, you know, apply. And also, I have a friend, she's an intuition expert, and what she talks about is she's like, hey, like everyone has intuitive and empathic capacities that they can even work on and develop, you know, kind of like a skill. Like, does that, just because you've worked on it, does that make you an empath now? Like, I don't know, but it's just kind of like, but I actually think it's something, again, like you're kind of medicalizing or fetishizing or trying to make a very normal human experience and capacity kind of special or different or unique, when I think lots of people would identify as being able to feel what other people feel, you know. So
It's interesting because it's been this shift in the media, and I've definitely noticed it in the time that I've been a journalist, in that we have now, in order to sell papers or get views or clicks or whatever, or on red tops, just kind of sell actual physical copies. It used to be, there's the phrase over here, I'm sure it's over there too, if it bleeds, it leads. And so newspaper headlines got really quite scary, salacious, I guess, in the 90s. And it's just escalated from there. And one of the shifts is that if there is, and let's use the celebrity world, if there is a high profile court case, so let's use Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, at some point, the media is going to take a position. One of those people is going to be evil, awful, never to be redeemable. And the other person is going to be the hero, the one who's been wronged by. So with Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, we know which way it went. The same is true with Meghan Markle, for example, who you there's no nuance there. It's just bad, 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 awful, 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 awful. And so I think this actually filters, as everything does. It's like cerulean blue from The Devil Wears Prada. It filters into real life. And that's where with narcissism and the empath dynamic showing up, it's like there can't be any nuance between this dynamic between two people that went wrong or isn't working. It's that one of them has to be evil and one of them has to be good. And of course, no one is going to read about that and think, yes, I'm the a-hole. They're going to identify with the good person.
Of course, yeah.
So I think it filters. It's an interesting how it filters into society.
Yeah, totally. I love that you just made a Devil's Wear Prada reference, because I made the same one just the other day. I was talking about, because you know, I've only been making content like 4 or 5 months. I'm still very new to it, and you know, I think I was kind of cynical about social media before. And I know a lot of our conversation has been about, like, you know, all these problems that are happening, but I see a lot of good on the platforms as well. And that very viral video that we've been referencing, the one about the misuse of the word trauma, you know, yes, for me on my page, on my Instagram, it was viewed like about 5.5 million times. But so many people have made stitches and responses of that video. I've also seen other content creators with similar brands to me. About a month later, they started talking about trauma and responsibility and victimhood mentality and like all these things. And it's, I just know for a fact, because the people who help me edit my videos and strategize are always sending me clips of things that go viral and be like, what can we borrow from this? And so I just have this sense that their social media manager was like, yo, check out, like, this is a really hot topic. Maybe we should touch on it to get engagement. And it really just, you know, enlightened me to like the power of social media. And so what I like to tell people now is I believe in it. Like someone who cares about social issues, you know, I believe in it in a way that I didn't believe in it before. And I kind of view it as like a public square in a certain sense. And I was explaining this to a buddy who's, you know, he's not on social media. He's kind of, you know, he's a little turned off by my, you know, recent content creator success. And I brought up The Devil Wears Prada because I said, hey, like, listen, like, it's not that you have to be on it, but, you know, don't go to the, you know, discount rack and pick out a sweater that's blue and think that you picked out that sweater, because at the higher level there's these conversations about these ideas happening. And I think that's reflected in a lot of my friends, you know, who I said who I would hear misuse the word trauma. It's like that was actually, those were ideas that were kind of trickled down in a sense to them, and those conversations were actually happening on podcasts and on social media and being written about in books. And so I think it's you know, it's such a wonderful scene in that movie, and it's it really kind of highlights how these things can spread. And with social media, they spread faster than ever nowadays.
But I think that's quite a difficult position, dare I say, for you to be in, because fundamentally what I think you're trying to bring to the conversation is responsible and is measured and is rooted in professionalism. And again, coming back, being responsible, that does seem to be the thing that we're coming back to. But that isn't a bleeds, if it bleeds, it leads kind of way of content creation. And as someone who's been creating online for a long time as well, you do follow those things. Sometimes you think so-and-so has just gone viral with that. Maybe I should do something. And then at some point you think, I have to stay in my lane, whilst also accepting that that means the numbers aren't going to go up necessarily. The followers aren't going to come. The reshares aren't going to happen because you're not presenting something sexy and new and different, which is what people, or that makes people feel a certain way all the time. But your content is your content and it's great. So I wonder if even though you're early in your process, whether you've started to feel that a little bit, whether you felt the pull towards going after the numbers.
I think for me, I'm approaching it as both. And I believe that Social, there are lots of ways to make a positive social impact. And one of the ways to do that is to marry the impact you want to create to a commercial interest, like social media. I think that the one thing that I have going with me, and I think it's one of the ways you might explain my quick growth as I've gotten started here, is that, a therapist getting on camera and being like, hey, you know what? It might not all be trauma. Like, it might be like, you know what, there actually is something kind of new and refreshing and, you know, a little bit, you know, bleeding about that too, if it bleeds and leads, because, even though I do my best to make the videos, measured, and responsible. And like I said earlier, I'm not doing it to be contrarian for the sake of just getting likes. I know that for whatever reason, there are going to be people that don't think that the nuance should be touched on. And whether they're right or wrong, or, you know, whatever it is that motivates them to do that, they're going to comment and they're going to drive engagement. And it's been my attitude. You're actually my second. This is my second podcast I've been asked to be on. My attitude is I'm very, very open about that. I'm like, listen, this is how it works, you know? And so that's the approach I'm taking. I don't know if have you been able to check out Toxic Therapy Bro on my page at all?
Oh yes. Yeah. So this is Tana. You created an AI therapy client/patient, and you're working through a session to sort of show the process.
Yeah, exactly. So it's I am using an augmented reality face filter to change my face. I actually took a few acting lessons, nothing super major, but to just kind of like help me, appear a little different outside of the facial change. And he's been a lot of fun. I'm going to start putting a lot more content out, focusing on him, because it's new and different. There is kind of this, again, there's kind of this, if it bleeds, it leads. It's like, oh, like, Toxic Therapy Bro, this kind of like angry dude whose girlfriend forced me into therapy, like, what's his deal? Like, what would therapy with him be like? There's, you know, kind of this intrigue. And I guess what I would say is that, you know, what we focused on today is, you know, the misuse of certain pop psychology terms. And that's not just an important issue socially, but it's an important content vertical for me right now. It's like, that is what people like listening to me talk about. And there's also been a lot of enthusiasm for like these other verticals, like Tanner, and kind of using social media in a way to be entertaining, but and also educate people about therapy. And the really fun thing I think about his concept is, you know, we all know we're not supposed to armchair diagnose people and use these terms, but my inspiration for him is, I was like, well, what if there was a fictional character where that was the point? And so that's what I say when people look at his videos. I go, what do you think his diagnosis is? I know what it is, and it will get revealed eventually, but you know, we're not there yet in his journey. And so it's fun and it's playful, and it doesn't necessarily have to be so, I think, doom and gloom to get engagement.
Well, it's also something I've never seen before, so I'm excited to see how Toxic Therapy Bro develops and evolves. Before I let you go, I do want to ask you, because there are a few more things on my list, but I do want to ask you about the cult of victimization. We've kind of talked about the cult of trauma, but the cult of victimization and this sort of, this idea of celebrating weakness and vulnerability. And again, from my perspective, what I see, particularly with content creation and content creators, is that if somebody goes through something difficult/traumatic mm-hmm. and writes put it this way, I have seen so many people basically write essays on social media about their mental health. And they put some nice twinkly music on the background, and then they get flooded with sending love. It gets so much engagement. And then it's almost as if, well, because that posted really well, I should probably talk about that thing that happened to me again and again and again and again. And I don't necessarily know how helpful that is. And so I've encountered this with talking about recovering from an eating disorder, in that I talk about it rarely, but when I do talk about it, it has to have a point, and it has to be what I hope is helpful to somebody, because my engagement will spike, but it doesn't necessarily help my recovery to exist in the space where I'm owning it, because I'm trying to move on and move forward.
Yeah, Yeah, that was that post was actually inspired from the original trauma video because debates about victimhood were just aplenty in the comments. And it's something that I've also noticed on social media. And the thing that it I want to how do I want to say this? I think the thing that I want people to take away is number one, I even say this in the video. I'm not saying that people aren't true victims to things. You know, that's not what I'm saying. I'm talking about a mentality and identity. And I think that, you know, as a mental health professional who has worked with people with, you know, what we might call like victimhood consciousness, victimhood identity, it's a rough place to be. And I say that with the most kind of, you know, care and compassion. I don't want people to be in that place. You know, I don't feel like I had the training or the knowledge to, you know, and frankly, it feels a little naive to say like, you know, I don't want there to be, you know, victims ever, you know. I would like there to be less victims in the world. That sounds nice. That sounds like a laudable goal, of course. But something I think I can speak to is, again, victimhood mentality or victimhood identity or victimhood consciousness. And the one of the more interesting things that I've seen in my comments, it was a separate video. I said something about how, you know, most mental illnesses can be cured, and if they can't be cured, you can manage them and live a wonderful, normal life. And that is true. I mean, you know, despite what, you know, you might see in the news about treatment resistant this and this, like most cases of PTSD are not unbelievably treatment resistant. You know, like there's a like actually like as it tr like if you know are feeling depressed and it's a mental or emotional etiology, like the origin is in your mind and it's you don't have like hormonal imbalance or something, therapy will help, you know. And I think it's a hopeful message. And I all these comments under that video were like, I don't see media talking about therapy success stories. And I was just like, you know what, I don't think I do either. And so the other side of that, you know, victimhood video is which is like that's I want to start talking about that more in the future. I'm actually talking with some other mental content creators. We want to do something like it, I don't know if it's exactly it, but it's something like hashtag breakthrough campaign, where it's kind of like this was a breakthrough I had in my therapy, like this was a breakthrough a patient had, like this is something to like also kind of help you understand yourself. Because I mean, I just think it makes so much sense, and I don't know why it's not more seen. Maybe it's what you said, which is, well, it's if it bleeds, it leads. It maybe isn't as, you know, titillating as a story, but I think that, you know, people also go and see movies about success stories and feel really inspired. And so I think we should maybe try talking about that a little bit more.
It's funny, isn't it? Because one of the reasons I first got into podcasting was because I was struggling. And actually, what I found with podcasting is like a plug into really positive conversations with people who were excelling. And so I was able to quiet what was going on in my own negative brain. And then I felt like we kind of fetishize success. And then I was slightly turned off by that. So, yeah, but everything's evolving. Everything's evolving. And it's kind of gone the other way with mental health. It's like, let's not talk about the success of mental health. Let's just label ourselves as having a mental health diagnosis, and then let's just stop there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have, you know, I've, you know, like I think about like a friend of mine with ADHD. It's like they have ADHD and they, you know, they manage it. And when they're really stressed or they're really tired or, you know, with the Adderall shortage right now, like, you know, like it was a little bit more, it's a little more obvious at times, but they work on it. You know, there's one of my favorite posts that I've made was the, I don't know if you caught it. It was the one where I say, the hook was, as a psychotherapist, I don't care about your mental health. I care about your character. And I talk about how when it comes to like loved ones and relationships, it's like whether or not you have a diagnosis, it actually just doesn't matter to me. It matters to me, do you work on it? Like, are you fun to be around? You know, like, are we close? Like, do I enjoy your companionship? Or like whatever it is, like those are the better questions for me. And I think it's and that's, in my opinion, a far better way to destigmatize mental health than to make your diagnosis your identity. one of my followers says, I'm forgetting who it was, or I would totally give him credit. I thought it was so funny, but he goes, remember everyone, treat it, don't tweet it. And I was just like, I just thought it was such a funny phrase. And I wholeheartedly agree.
I love it. Treat it, don't tweet it. I might have to steal that. It's been so fascinating to talk to you. And I really appreciate your insights and your perspective on all of this, because I think it is really measured and I think it is really responsible. So thank you.
Thank you so much. If you have, if there's anything else you want to kind of riff about, I have a little time. No pressure. I know we're coming up on an hour, but we're also happy to wrap up.
Yes. No. Do you know what? The only other thing I was thinking of is when we were talking about trauma, I was thinking about podcasts, and one of the podcasts I used to listen to loads was Tim Ferriss. And I am back in the room a little bit with Tim at the moment, but I sort of opted out when he went into angel investing, but at the time he was talking about all of the money he was putting into research into psilocybin and PTSD over in the States. And I think that the evidence for treatment of PTSD, particularly in returning vets, has been astounding. I haven't seen the papers. I've only heard information on the podcast, but I think it's really interesting that a podcast that I probably heard from Tim maybe 5 years ago, and now what I'm hearing out in the, albeit media world, is a lot of people microdosing because they're like, well, I probably have some trauma, and that's really good for trauma, isn't it? Well, that's really good for stress. And I think there's this weird thing of, again, it's the cerulean blue. It's like, here's all this incredible research that's going into psilocybin in universities in the right conditions. And then it's on the street and people who are having a bad day are like, oh, best do some microdosing.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So what I will say is, from what I know, the research is promising as well. With PTSD, I also know the MDMA research that's come out. This is not my focus area, so I'm not super fluent in it, but the people who I've talked to who are like, we can't even believe it. Like, it's actually like, really, really exciting and amazing. And I have a similar concern about this MDMA research that's starting to come out, kind of like you pointed to, where it's like, well, are people just going to start like rolling all the time and be like, well, it's good for your trauma? Because and I think that it's a little bit like people are like, well, this wine is good for my anxiety. It's like, yeah, like it is, like temporarily, When it comes to the psilocybin, I am not a critic of plant medicine or kind of psychedelic medicine. I will, leave everyone listening with this thought, which is, I have seen clinically and personally people who get really, really into going on journeys and microdosing, and over time, and this is just me anecdotally, they have started to occur to me as completely different people.
Yep.
Like a completely different personality, and not in a good way. Like, it's like you're actually like harder to be around.
Yeah.
And I wonder, there's so many factors. There's their body chemistry, there's their ability to navigate consciousness, there's how often they were doing it, how much they were doing it. But I think that people that really work in this space would also say, like, did they do it intentionally, and did they integrate? Microdosing and going to concerts all the time is very, very different, from, maybe some self-guided exploration. And again, it really isn't my area, but I leave that with just, it's just like a friendly caution. It's like, these things do have therapeutic value, it seems. And that doesn't make them safe. That doesn't make them without consequences. In fact, they have consequences because of the long-term outcome studies that are coming out about using these things therapeutically. You know what I mean? So it's like, that's just where I'll kind of leave it at that. It's it'll be interesting to see how all that shakes out.
I mean, I'm no psychic, and I'm definitely not going to get us started on that, but I think a book is in your future, Joe.
Thank you so much. I am in the process of writing one about pop psychology terms. Go figure. It's been my most popular content vertical, and nothing is definitive yet, but I'm in conversations with people about my own podcast. And so I really appreciate you having me. And it's, I was on someone else's last week, and it's again, this is my second one. And so just like, thank you for like, just like the practice. And it's been so fun to talk to you. We got to do it again. And
I think so.
And yeah, even if, you know, and then if you have any, you know, feedback for me after the recording, I would welcome it. So.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll definitely stay in touch. Don't you worry about that. But in the meantime, yeah. I will make sure that the links to Joe are in the show notes. But it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining me, Joe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I appreciate your time hugely. If you did enjoy it and you never want to miss an episode, then please do hit the subscribe button wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. It's also where you get the opportunity to leave a 5-star review and a rating for how you feel about the show. And I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't mind leaving one. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Guns. If you fancy chatting to me and thousands of other fellow listeners of the podcast, then click the link to join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. You have to answer a couple of questions, but we cannot wait to see you there. Come over and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.